You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin high schoolers will be able to compete in the state's first civics games this year. We'll find out more and talk about the state of civics education in Wisconsin. First, President Trump ordered the closure of the Palestinian Liberation Organization office in Washington, D.C. this week. The group, known as the PLO, is recognized by many countries as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. The move is being seen as an attempt to put pressure on Palestinians to negotiate on a plan for peace in the Middle East. Karen DeYoung is an associate editor and senior national security correspondent at The Washington Post. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
We'll talk about what the administration said about this decision. Why did they say they were shutting down this office effectively?
Well, this was announced by the State Department and in a speech Monday by John Bolton, President Trump's national security advisor, who gave two reasons. He said that the PLO had not taken steps to advance meaningful negotiations with Israel, between Israel and the Palestinians. And he said that the PLO, which is an observer member of the United Nations, had lodged complaints against Israel with the International Criminal Court, which is a body located in The Hague that investigates war crimes and human rights abuses that is not recognized by the United States.
Can you talk about what this office is? It isn't technically an embassy or consulate, right? So what was the status of it?
No, it's not an embassy. And the United States, of course, and virtually no one else recognizes a Palestinian state. And the PLO is kind of an umbrella group that recognizes the Palestinian people, and it's long been recognized as such by the United Nations and by many other countries. You know, its status was kind of downgraded with the Oslo Accords 25 years ago and various agreements that established an actual government in the West Bank, which is run by something called the Palestinian Authority, but Mahmoud Abbas, who's president of the Palestinian Authority, is also chairman of the PLO. And so this office was opened in Washington, again, as a result of the Oslo Accords, in which Israel and the PLO agreed to recognize each other's legitimate right to exist, and was kind of a time of incipient peace that never really materialized. But nonetheless, the PLO office here was authorized at that time. And it's, again, it's not an embassy, but it gives some representation by the Palestinians in Washington. And it gives them a vehicle to be in contact with Congress, to essentially speak to the American people.
Can you talk about other recent steps from the Trump administration regarding the Palestinians? They've, for example, cut some funding for various refugee and hospital services, right?
Yes. Well, this has been something that started late last year, as the administration said it was at some point going to release a peace plan, a proposal for peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. The first thing it did was last December, President Trump announced that the United States would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Of course, the United States and virtually every other country have always had their embassies in Israel and Tel Aviv to avoid making a declaration on Jerusalem, which was always supposed to be a subject of negotiation with the Palestinians because the Palestinians say their capital should be there. So Trump said, no, we recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. More recently, the administration cut financial aid that it gives to the Palestinian Authority, the governing body on the West Bank, and then announced a couple of weeks ago that it was no longer going to be a contributor to the United Nations program that takes care of about 5 million Palestinian refugees scattered around the Middle East. It announced that it was no longer going to give money to a group of hospitals in Jerusalem that primarily serve Palestinian patients, and basically sort of cut off the Palestinians from any U.S. assistance.
Talking to Karen DeYoung from The Washington Post, talking about the Trump administration's moves on various Palestinian issues, the latest shutting down an office of the Palestinian Liberation Organization in Washington. Karen, what's been the Palestinian response from the PLO and or Palestinian Authority?
Well, the Palestinian Authority said immediately after the Jerusalem announcement that they would no longer speak to the United States about a peace process because they didn't consider the United States an honest broker anymore. Again, this so-called peace plan has been awaited now for throughout the Trump administration. I mean, Trump said at the very beginning of the administration that he thought it was something that would come out before the end of his first year. It never has come out, and there are lots of charges that they're basically trying to squeeze the Palestinians from a pro-Israel perspective in order to kind of, according to the Palestinians, sort of rig the peace process before it even gets started. The administration says, you know, how can the Palestinians refuse to talk to us about a plan they haven't even seen? And the Palestinians say, well, we don't need to see the plan. We've seen all these other things you do, and you're obviously not an honest broker.
And it seems at this point like this could be a never-ending cycle. Palestinians say they're not going to negotiate. The White House takes steps to squeeze them into negotiations, which the Palestinians read as bad faith on the Americans' part. It just is a potentially never-ending cycle, right?
Exactly. Well, I think, you know, if you listen to the administration, eventually they will come out with a plan. What it will say and whether it will be acceptable to either side, we don't know because nobody knows what's in it yet.
Do we know who's crafting this plan for the administration?
Yeah, the lead role is by Jared Kushner, who's a senior White House advisor and President Trump's son-in-law, aided by Jason Greenblatt, who was brought into the White House. He was a bankruptcy lawyer in New York for the Trump administration, the Trump organization, Trump's company, and he was brought in as head negotiator. And so it's basically the two of them, along with Daniel Friedman, who's the administration's ambassador to Israel.
Are Palestinians looking to other parts of the international community to serve as an arbiter here if they don't have faith in what the U.S. is doing?
Well, I think that they're trying to get Arab countries who have traditionally been supporters of theirs kind of put pressure on the administration. The administration is putting pressure on those same Arab countries to be more friendly to Israel on grounds that they all don't like Iran. I think that the Palestinians are talking to European countries. The United Nations is trying to get other countries to cough up money for refugees at the United States, which previously was the largest individual donor to the refugee accounts, to cough up some more money. So there's a lot of stuff going on, but I think basically, one of the results has been more hardship for Palestinians in the West Bank and certainly in Gaza.
Briefly, what breaks this impasse?
Nobody knows. Nobody knows. You know, I mean, as I said, at some point, presumably the administration will come out with its plan, and that will then give everybody a basis to actually talk in substantive terms about what's going on. So far, again, this plan, assuming it's been written, which the administration says it has been very closely held. None of the people who are parties to it know what it says or are supposed to be parties to it. So I think that that's kind of the next step. And there's not much more that the administration can do to put the squeeze on the Palestinians. So I think that will be the next thing that we're waiting for. But nobody knows when it's going to happen.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was Karen DeYoung, Associate Editor and Senior National Security Correspondent for The Washington Post, with us to talk about the Trump administration's decision to close the PLO office in Washington, D.C. Most of us will remember taking a civics class at some point during our school years, or maybe you're taking one right now. It's an important topic for a lot of educators, but it doesn't get the same attention sometimes as things like math and reading. A new competition aims to get more high schoolers involved. The Wisconsin Civics Games, spearheaded by the Wisconsin Newspaper Association, makes its debut this school year. The games will start with 7 regional competitions around the state in January of next year. The winning teams will then advance to a championship round in Madison. You can find more info about competing at WisconsinCivicsGames.com. David Helpap is an associate professor of history at UW-Green Bay, one of the host sites for the regional competition in the Wisconsin Civics Games. David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when you heard about this idea of a high school civics competition, that your university was going to host a part of it here, what did you think? Sound like a good idea?
Yeah, absolutely. As a political scientist, we're always interested in getting students, obviously, interested in civics and encouraging them to be a part of the political process. And I think this is a fantastic way to get high school students excited about that.
That's my understanding, that students there at UW-Green Bay are going to help write questions for the civics game, so they get to be part of the fun, too. Can you give us a sense of the range of topics the high school competitors might be facing?
Well, it's certainly going to be, as you said, the questions are still being developed, but it is certainly going to be a broad range of topics, and those topics are going to kind of function as a foundation for broad civics education, and also I'm sure they're going to relate quite closely to the civics exams that Wisconsin high school students have to take. So it should provide a nice foundation for that, and also hopefully get them excited to participate in maybe civics classes or just civic engagement more generally when they move on to college or whatever they do following graduation.
Are there things in our school curriculum that you think need more emphasis when it comes to civics for students?
Well, you know, as you stated, there are a lot of topics that are getting attention right now: science, technology, engineering, math, which is all well and good. But at the same time, it's important to learn about civics, especially in this political environment that we currently have, which tends to be highly polarized. There's a lot of rhetoric. An inability to have a discussion about civics and politics in a very kind of civil way. So encouraging students to kind of learn the background, learn the primary information, but also get them to learn about how to have a conversation about politics and controversial issues without really attacking individuals and ideas is going to be important.
I think a lot of times when people think of politics and politicians and the law and lawyers for that matter, there's a negative connotation there, and that maybe steers people away from getting involved at the local or higher levels. Is there a way to teach these subjects that says, hey, it's not necessarily a dirty thing to be involved in?
Right. Absolutely. I think teaching students kind of how to think about politics and not necessarily what to think about politics. So talking about data and fact-based research and kind of what we know from our experience in politics is an important way to do that. And also just especially at the high school level to make it fun and interactive and to get them talking about this type of subject. And I think this is something that these games will accomplish, and it should get students kind of excited to move forward with this topic.
Now you're at UW-Green Bay. You're working with college students who very recently were high school students. Do you feel like there is a hunger for knowing more about the civic world around them?
Personally, I think so. I work with a lot of, obviously, political science, public administration majors. But at the same time, when we see students coming out of high school and into college, they tend to be the group of voters that vote less than other groups. And what this does is that it means that they're perhaps not as well represented when it comes to public policies and things like that. So the more we get students to engage in the political process earlier in their lives, the better the chance that they will kind of continue to participate and be involved as they move through kind of their 20s and into later into their life.
Now, when we think of civics education, we think of, you know, the checks and balances, how a bill becomes a law, that sort of thing. I understand you teach history as well as political science. Is that an important part of the story here, too?
Well, yeah. I mean, history is certainly, our country's history is what kind of defines our current political environment to some degree. So learning kind of what has worked and what has not worked in the past, learning about different groups as they've moved through our country's history, this all kind of culminates in the current political environment that we see today. And you need some understanding of that historical context in order to really grasp, you know, the current events.
Been looking at the positives here. What's the downside if kids don't learn enough about civics, if they don't have that desire to be involved in one way or another? What do we lose as a society?
Well, these students are our next generation of voters and leaders and kind of community, community leaders. So we want them to be well-informed, and we want them even right now to participate so that their voices can be heard in the political process. Because if elected officials aren't really paying much attention, then those needs aren't being met. And as people retire and offices become open, we want these students to run for office and be a part of that process. Local elections especially, there tend to be a lot of uncontested races. And we would like, obviously, a big exchange of ideas at the local level.
Let's bring it home as we wrap up in our last few moments. If there are teachers, students, or administrators listening, can you make the case that they should check out the Wisconsin Civics Games and see what it takes to field a team?
Yeah, I mean, it should be a fun, interactive way to encourage participation in civics. It's being put on, obviously, by the Wisconsin Newspapers Association. High schools, college partners, university partners, and a lot of other high-profile partners across the state. So, I mean, this is something that people are investing quite a bit in, and it should be, I think, a fantastic way to kind of move people into these topics, even if they don't want to major in political science or history or something like that. These topics still matter to them, and they're still important. And it's important to have that knowledge just to be an informed and an active citizen.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
David Halpab is an associate professor of history at UW-Green Bay. He was with us to talk about the importance of civics education ahead of the inaugural Wisconsin Civics Games for high schoolers this year. You can find out more at wisconsincivicsgames.com. Former Cosby Show cast member Jeffrey Owens was spotted bagging groceries at a New Jersey Trader Joe's. A photo of Owens at work was taken and posted on Twitter by Fox News and the Daily Mail. Some people mocked him, but then there was a backlash. Among people, including our next guest, who says this is a good time to talk about the dignity of all kinds of work. Marshall Ramsey is an editorial cartoonist and columnist for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. He's also a radio and TV host for Mississippi Public Broadcasting. He found a lesson in this Twitter thread and recently wrote the piece, Jeffrey Owens and a Salute to the Sacredness of Work. Marshall, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, this is wonderful, and I feel kind of guilty because I took off early from work to talk to you.
That's okay. You don't have to feel guilty about talking to us anytime, fellow public radio, public broadcasting person. So for people who don't follow Twitter that much, give us a little more on this story with this Cosby Show actor Jeffrey Owens.
Well, I tell you, you know, to be honest with you, I don't normally do Twitter outrage just because it's exhausting. And, you know, I mean, I'm an editorial cartoonist, so I kind of get a lot of stuff like that. But I opened it up one morning, and there was this tweet, and it showed, of course, I mean, Jeffrey Owens sitting there in his Trader Joe's shirt, and it was a little dirty, and it looked like he was a little overweight, and he had a gray beard, and it was like Cosby actor Jeffrey Owens spotted bagging groceries at New Jersey Trader Joe's. And I thought, well, what's wrong with that? I mean, the guy's out there working, making a living for his kids, and I mean, it just completely kind of, it actually made me mad. And I was like, that doesn't happen that often on Twitter. And so I looked at it and I just said, well, you know, I think this is worthy of writing about. And I thought about a job that I used to have that I didn't really think was such a great job that turned out to be one of my best jobs.
Yeah, talk about that job. You had a job that maybe people didn't always respect.
Yeah, I was a custodian one, at Pope High School in Marietta, Georgia. And this was my first job out of college. It was not on my career path initially, and needless to say, my dad was slightly surprised when I got this job. But and just to let you know, custodian one is not the best kind of custodian. Custodian two was the best kind of custodian. So I wasn't even the best kind of custodian. But, I wanted to be an editorial cartoonist, and I'd won all these awards, and I thought, man, I've got it made. And I obviously was very bad at math, because there were only about 200 jobs in the country at the time and 300 million people. There was going to be a problem there, and I just didn't realize it. So I ended up being a night janitor. And for about 6 months, I was miserable. And then I got a little bit of an attitude change.
Yeah, what changed your attitude?
You know, it was one of those deals where I just started thinking about, I've got this talent, and I'm not using it. And I started thinking about, Sunday school as a kid, the parable of the talents, and I was like, I'm the servant who's bearing his talent. And so I went into work the next day with a really good attitude, and they drug tested me immediately. They didn't know what was going on. And I started drawing. I mean, I drew for the cross-country team's T-shirts. I drew caricatures of the teacher's husbands. I would draw on the walls, and I'd clean it off because I could do that. I was a janitor. And doors started opening up. And I worked with a lady named Maggie. And Maggie was awesome. I thought she was old at the time. She was 45, and I wish I could still remember 45. But Maggie's husband had been an Eastern Airline pilot. And she had never had to work before because he'd done pretty well as an Eastern Airline pilot. And as you remember, they, of course, went out on strike, and Maggie, had to go to work. And she came and worked there as a custodian also. And she kind of taught me very quickly that she would look at me and say, you're just blessed to have a job. You're lucky to have a job. And after a while, one day she came up to me and she said, you really are a nice guy. I said, well, thank you. She said, how would you like to go out with my daughter? And I thought, man, your standards for your daughter are kind of low here, aren't they? And I met her daughter. She had great, prettiest blue eyes I'd ever seen. And I always like telling that story because here I thought I had the worst job in the world, and I ended up marrying, her daughter and having three great kids that look just like her daughter. So, I always tell people, whenever you think you've got a bad situation, you really don't. You probably have a pretty good one. You just don't recognize it.
Now, that's from the inside out, but there's also the things that, happen to Jeffrey Owens, people kind of laughing at how he fell, the indignity in some ways. And you experienced that as a janitor, too, the respect coming from others or lack of same. Can you talk about that?
I did, and it really changed, I think, who I was as a person because, I was a cocky college kid, and I thought I was hot stuff and everything. And one night, there had been a basketball game or something, and I was mopping the hall. And this parent, I guess, came walking down the hall, and he walked right down the middle of where I had just mopped. And I wasn't rude to him, but I just said, excuse me. And he just turned around and just, kind of gave me the look like I was just trash. And I just said, and I really felt like I was about 3 feet tall for a second. And then I was like, how dare he talk to me like that? And who is this guy? And then I thought for a second, well, it doesn't really matter. Who cares what he thinks of me, And there is a great Mississippi songwriter, singer. He plays with Jimmy Buffett at the Coral Reefer Band. It's a guy named Mac McAnally. And Mac is just incredibly talented guy. And he wrote a song called It's My Job. And Jimmy Buffett's covered it as well. And it has the lines, it says, it's my job to be cleaning up this mess, and that's enough reason to go for me. It's my job to be better than the rest, and that makes the day for me. And I start thinking about that as this dude's walking right down the middle of my clean floor. And from that point on, I said, if somebody's pushing them up, or if they're the CEO, I'm going to treat them equally, because they're both dignified people working. And
we have that song queued up. Here's a little listen to Mac McAnally and It's My Job.
In the middle of late last night, I was sitting on a curb. I didn't know what about, I was feeling quite disturbed. Street sweeper came whistling by, he was bouncing every step. It seemed strange how good he felt, so I asked him while he swept. He said, it's my job to be cleaning up this mess, and that's enough reason to go for me. It's my job to be better than the best, and that makes the day for me.
Talking to Marshall Ramsey from the Clarion Ledger and Mississippi Public Broadcasting, talking about dignity and respect of people at work. Marshall, how can we have a culture change so people don't look at somebody in whatever job it is and look down on them?
You know, I think the silver lining in this whole Jeffrey Owens thing was, number one, the backlash. It was great to see people step up and say, you know what, there is nothing wrong with somebody out there hustling and working hard to make a living for their family. But I think in another way, Jeffrey Owens himself turned out to be a wonderful ambassador. And, you know, I mean, I remember watching The Cosby Show as a kid, you know, I didn't much care for his character. I thought it was okay. I had nothing against him personally. But, man, I was sitting there watching interview after interview and going, this guy's like, I was ready to break down a wall and get, you know, pick up a shovel and get to work on this. But I think conversations like you and I are having right now are incredibly important. And, you know, we're here in the 10th anniversary of the Great Recession, which was an incredible meltdown. And a lot of people, you know, literally had to scramble to make ends meet for their family. And I think it's time for us to sit down and celebrate what has gone on in this country and the fact that people have been able to hustle and get things done.
I want to give a listen to Jeffrey Owens. I hear he is talking about this Twitter storm. He's talking here on Good Morning America.
And I do want to say this. I, this business of my being the Cosby guy who got shamed for working at Trader Joe's, that's going to pass. I hope what doesn't pass is this idea that people are now thinking, this rethinking about what it means to work. You know, the honor of the working person and the dignity of work. And I hope that this period that we're in now, where we have a heightened sensitivity about that and a reevaluation of what it means to work, and that a reevaluation of the idea that some jobs are better than others, because that's actually not true. There is no job that's better than another job. It might pay better, it might have better benefits, it might look better on a resume and on paper, but actually it's not better.
Marshall, we've talked about kind of people, how people feel about their own job, how they look at the jobs of others. I want to bring in a third element, how people are treated by employers. Do you think there's a way that employers, managers, owners of a business, whatever, can make sure that their employees feel like they're treated with respect?
I tell you, if you are truly a boss who is concerned about the bottom line and you're really worried about being profitable, you know, a good place to start is treating your employees a little bit better. It makes a huge difference on that. And, you know, and I think of all my bosses that I've had, and I've had two or three of them that are just absolutely amazing, and I would have literally just jumped out in front of a truck for them. I worked extra time. I did whatever I could. So, I mean, really, I'm just pure economic front. It just makes dollars and cents to treat your employees better.
So, Marshall, as we wrap up, do you see this as a case where maybe Twitter outrage can have a good result as a conversation starter?
You know, it's 2018. There has been all kinds of weird things happen this year. So who'd have thunk that Twitter actually could, you know, and Twitter outrage could actually produce something important. But I, like I said, I've been on Twitter a long time, and it was one of the few times something really kind of riled me up. And just seeing everybody's comments about, and people talking about those jobs that they had that helped form them, I think it's just incredible.
Marshall, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Marshall Ramsey is an editorial cartoonist and columnist for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi, also a radio and TV host for Mississippi Public Broadcasting. Recently wrote the piece Jeffrey Owens and a Salute to the Sacredness of Work. This comes from a former Cosby Show actor being photographed bagging groceries, being mocked a bit, and then a huge backlash against that mockery. Well, now that we've heard our guest story, we want to hear yours. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you worked or do you work in a job or industry that doesn't get treated well, doesn't get a lot of respect? What have you learned from that experience? Do you have more respect for workers after spending some time in their shoes? Do you think people treat service workers, maybe in particular, or other people in different lines of work poorly? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue to talk about respect and dignity at the workplace, no matter the job or the pay. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. This started with the Twitter storm. Actor Jeffrey Owens of the 80s Cosby Show photographed working, bagging groceries, mocked for that, and then a big backlash saying, hey, what's wrong with that? Call 800-642-1234. Have you in the past, or do you now work at a job that you think doesn't always get the respect it deserves? What is that like for you? How does a job like that shape you? What can make it better? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. We've got Chris with us in Plover. Chris, hi.
Yeah, hi. I've had many undesirable jobs and, of course, working as much as I could to get ahead. And I often said, coming from a farm background, I would say, you know, I'd shovel pig poop with a teaspoon for a time and a half. And then when I went through college, learning that the devaluation of manual labor is historically rooted in the South, and because the slaves did the manual labor and the whites did not, and then carried over, unfortunately, into the union movement, and that's not my job because of union differentiation of jobs. But, I'd do anything, and work of any kind with pride is great thing.
And Chris, doing those jobs, did you feel sometimes like you were looked down on for doing a manual labor job, say?
Oh, absolutely. I was a correctional officer for a while, and that is a very tough and demanding job in a negative environment. And you're just a prison guard was a frequent type of attitude, but you know, that's an individual that needs to be there for society's sake.
Chris, thanks a lot for starting us off. We'll go next to Mike on the line in Superior. Mike, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Just the way that it goes a long way with the way the caller a little bit before was talking about treating your employees a little bit better. And it's like the employers have blinders onto that, and they want to seem to just keep going about the way they employ people. And currently about a 10% massive employment where I'm at is, you know, the turnover rate is out of control. Out of every 10 guys that get hired, only one makes it after a few months. So,
and do you think, is it something as simple as just a little more, I guess, respect, better treatment might lower that turnover rate?
Oh, absolutely. I know it would, for sure, because that's the main complaint for why guys leave. If they don't get fired, they quit because of the way they're treated.
Mike, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Sorry to hear that, and good luck to you. We are taking your calls about jobs that, you know, maybe don't get a lot of respect in society, maybe jobs that you are doing or have done in the past, and how you treat people, maybe in the service industry when you interact with them. Mark is with us now in Eau Claire. Mark, hi.
Hey, I am a very well-educated young man. I have a college degree. I have a master's degree. I was salaried. I had 3 weeks of vacation, all my insurance, everything. It was killing my family, and I just walked away. And we needed money to pay the rent. We needed money for food on the table. I went from a professional job to wiping tables at Culver's and cleaning the bathrooms. And I brought my professionalism to the job, and my boss was just excited beyond all belief to have me. But here I am, wiping tables at Culver's, and I was proud of myself for that job. That was an awesome job.
Mark,
you're going to shame me.
Thanks a lot. Did you get a sense from maybe people you knew and saw you make that change that there was some kind of judgment call on you?
I had that judgment call on myself. I judged myself as being less than, but I learned real quick. You don't do that. You respect yourself. You hold your head up high. You go to work and you do what's right for your family. And anybody who's going to shame you, that's a shame on them.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Yvonne in Springfield Crossing. Hi.
Hi. I'm Yvonne, and I'm a CNA, and I've been doing frontline work, caring for people for over 18 years, and I love it. And there are people who look down on me, but if you talk to the people who I care for, I am the cream of the crop. I am like that 10%. I'm not a glorified babysitter. And it just angers me that this, I don't know who this Cosby person is you're talking about, but if he's bagging groceries at Trader Joe's and he has dignity and respect and he's proud of his job, then just leave the man alone. I do my job because I love it, and there's a high burnout rate when it comes to CNAs, but you know what? I love it, and I hope to do it for the rest of my life.
Yvonne, we've talked on the show before about, you know, there aren't enough of you out there, enough CNAs who are doing the job, staying in the job. Do you think, I mean, the pay isn't always great, I know, but do you think that that respect issue is part of what makes other people not stick with it?
Well, part of the problem is I actually worked for a very large company that hospitals recommend. And when I went in, I seen other CNAs yelling and screaming at patients that they're supposed to take care of. And that is abuse and neglect. And when I brought it up to my managers, they said, I am not to talk about it, that the families are to bring this up. And I was thinking to myself, wait a second, you're talking about a man who has dementia. You're talking about a 99-year-old woman who is blind. And so where I see it is there's a lot of pressure from management, and you're not treated and you're not given a lot of respect because, and I worked for another company for 13 years. And that particular company, the more I did, the more they expected, and they didn't listen. Like if there were complaints or something, they didn't listen, and it was very, very difficult.
Yvonne, thanks a lot for sharing your experiences. We're talking about the dignity of work, respect for people doing jobs, even if they're not jobs that always get respect. Sarah is with us next in Green Bay. Sarah, hi.
Hi. I think it's pretty neat about what Mark was saying, the one that works at Culver's, because that ties into what I was going to say. I find it just so shameful that people seem to look down on people who work in the fast food or fast casual industry, yet they look at servers at sit-down restaurants as they're better. They're all doing a service for you. They're bringing you food. And I can tell you that those people, especially when they start getting into leadership positions in those, in those fast food industries, they have to have so much knowledge on how to run that place and how to get those specials out that only come out limited time offers. They could probably run circles around some people that work as accountants in offices. They have a lot of things that they do, and they're very intelligent about what they do. And it's just such a shame that everybody looks down on them, especially when they're doing what you want them to do for you, which is give you food.
Sarah, thanks a lot for that. Dan is with us next in Menominee. Dan, hello.
Hi there. So I used to work as a night janitor at a public pool. So, you know, kind of a messy job. And when I would tell people this, what I got from them wasn't disrespect. It was more of a look of pity. And I would have to explain, like, no, this is an awesome job. Nobody's breathing down my neck. I get to play my music really loud. And so I feel like we place too much on the dignity of work. There are jobs that are, you know, higher respect levels and everything. But, you know, a job is just a job.
All right, Dan. Time for one more quick call. Leah in Green Bay. Leah, just briefly, hi.
Hi. I'm a nursing instructor, and I make it a point to tell my nursing students that the housekeeping and environmental services, these are the people and their jobs are what make the hospital run. It's not the doctors and the nurses and administration. We housekeeping and environmental services run the hospital. Without them, the doctors and nurses can't do their jobs. But the environmental services and housekeeping can sure do their jobs without housekeeping. Right? You get what I'm saying?
I sure do, Leah. Thanks a lot. Good place to leave it. Thanks for all of your calls. You can keep sharing your stories. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.